Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm on Capitol Hill. I represent the political center and have on the political right and in his office, Senator Dan McKay.
Good morning, everyone.
And on the left, former Senator Jim DeBacchus.
So good to be up here in the Capitol and not have to go into the Capitol.
Yeah, you get to hang out on the periphery. Isn't your pledge to stay out of the actual Capitol building, Jim?
Yeah, that's my pledge.
For people that don't spend a lot of time up here.
We have a restraining order, actually, on Jim.
It's really interesting what a club it is and what a, I don't know, the term you use is inside baseball. But you see all the same familiar faces year after year doing their work up here on the Hill.
All the same familiar faces. Yep.
But we're in the Senate office building, and I want to talk about the national news that happened this week. We had our president declare a national emergency at the southern border. Dan, will this hold up legally? You're the attorney in the room.
I think it will, but I just don't know if it... Not I don't know. It is not the right way to do things, mm-hmm. But every president you had, George H.W. Bush... William Clinton, George W. Bush, and I'm going down the whole...
I hope you'll say Barack Hussein Obama.
Barack Hussein Obama.
You're doing all these full names.
Right? You go down that list, and I'm telling you, every single one of them has said, there is a problem, it's a national emergency, we need to do something about it, and then waited for Congress to diddle away both the sovereignty of the United States... and its ability to protect itself.
Yeah. Jim, there was no surprise in him doing this. What I think is going to be a little tricky is the way he takes money away from defense projects, other construction projects that are more worthy of the U.S. taxpayers' money.
You know, I think there's a basic misconception here when you say they all did it. There's a difference between an executive order and a national emergency declaration. The national emergency declaration is not just a run-of-the-mill executive order. It is something very special where there's a timetable, there's an emergency, there's a war, there's
money.
Land that needs, there's something that needs to be spent in Afghanistan. It's not just I have a policy difference, therefore I'm calling whatever it is a national emergency. Congress has already debated this and gone against me. This is a whole new dimension of the federal government taking control and of the Congress laying its responsibilities into the hands of the executive. It is a very, very treacherous move, and it is a step that none of the presidents that Dan mentioned had taken. It's an entirely new step. And it killed
Jim,
me one other thing.
Okay.
So Mike Lee puts out these two quotes.
Dan, this is
one
the
day
regular,
after another.
Hammering on Senator Lee.
This is the tweet on Friday. Congress has been ceding far too much power to the executive branch for decades. We should use this moment as an opportunity to start taking that power back. Next day. Trump is acting legally, and it stems from the National Emergencies Act. Many of Trump's predecessors have used that power as a threshold matter. Today's decree is lawful. Come on, Senator. You can't have it both ways.
But, Jim, I thought you'd be happy to see your other favorite member of the Utah congressional delegation, Representative Chris Stewart, who actually took on the president on this issue. And that's a rare thing for him to do.
Doesn't fit Jim's dialogue.
Okay.
So it can't be discussed, Natalie.
Yeah.
Way to go, Chris.
Oh, thank you.
I know we've talked about this before, and this is such a stretch, but I did hear an NPR report this week about Clarence Thomas and how there's a little whisper rumor mill in Washington that, you know, maybe he won't, maybe he'll step down and give Trump another appointee to the Supreme Court. Anyway, I can't help when we see Senator Lee doing things if he's not thinking a little bit about the SCOTUS.
Well, I think he is. I think he's.
I knew Jim would agree with me.
I think he's obsessed by it. I think that's what he wants to do. I think he's finding the Senate to be pretty non-productive, boring. He doesn't have a lot of friends there.
And I disagree with that. I think he loves his job and he's writing books and doing things. But I do think that he would love a position on the Supreme Court. and given his profile,
background,
and,
expertise,
yeah, what he's done,
his father's heritage, right?
Yeah,
you go through
yeah.
those things, but even better,
and it's an outside shot, but you know,
right? It would be good for Utah. It'd be good for all those things. I'll just say the Supreme Court nomination.
Good for you.
Come on, Jim. Come on, hold it together here.
All right, sorry.
Okay, look. I think, though, Mike is a thoughtful jurist as far as how the law is concerned. I don't know the Thomas scuttle,
yeah.
and so I'm so
they
kind of
say,
out of
they
that
said
removal.
In the report
but,
that he and his wife are having dinner at the White House a lot, and it's a cozy relationship. Whatever.
Yeah.
Hey, Dan, you're a political.
Can I get
okay,
Mike?
Sure.
If Clarence Thomas did leave, I would like to go against most everything I've ever said and say I think Orrin Hatch would make a terrific nominee to the Supreme Court after all.
Yeah, I see that. Now, but
that's
Senator Hatch, you know, for all intents and purposes, Senator Hatch was also leveled with the same criticism early in his career, mm-hmm. that his whole aim, his whole focus was
yeah,
get on the
happened.
Supreme Court.
Yeah,
never happened. So,
Dan, you're a good political strategist. You, in my experience, you always know the little minute details. So we have Senator Bernie Sanders, who enters the 2020 presidential race.
Love it. Love it. Bring on Bernie.
Well, tell me what this does to the, you know, slate of candidates challenging Donald Trump from the Democratic side. What does it do with the sharing of votes? And then we'll get Jim's reaction to it. But
okay.
Is this good news for people that like Trump or bad news for people
it
who like Trump?
It is great news for people who like Donald Trump.
Okay.
Because here's what happens. Democrats and Republicans, for that matter,
I knew you'd know the answer to this.
They always learn the wrong lesson from elections. They always do, right? So when you lose an election, they always double down with some bad idea. The Democrats always, to their point, they always go way to the right when they lose a president, or way to the left when they lose a presidential election. Walter Mondale, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I could go down the list after list. John Kerry, same thing. You go down all of these presidential nominees the Democrats have put up after losing an election, and it is always further to the left. And I think, in my mind, you watch. The Democrats won't be able to help themselves. It's going to be a Bernie off, and someone of Bernie's let's be socialist, let's get this over with, let's be socialist and start that. That's who the nominee is.
Yeah.
And my favorite part about that is it brings America back to, do we really want to be socialist?
Yeah, it brings you right into the Donald Trump narrative that he's testing.
He did not win the popular vote last time. The president did not. Mm-hmm. He will this time if the nominee is Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. Jim, your reaction to that?
So there's some truth to what Dan says. I remember 1972. After losing a very close race against Richard Nixon, they came back with the most liberal person that anybody'd ever heard of. Didn't even win his home state. That's possible. And I'm saying to Democrats, look, you have a choice. And that is any Democrat that can win Ohio, that can win Wisconsin, that can win Pennsylvania, or it's a crapshoot about Donald Trump being president. So you want the most extreme, you want everything you want it this election, you gamble the farm on four more years of Donald Trump, you pick a Klobuchar, you pick Joe Biden, you pick somebody that can win those states, or, you know, maybe one of the other candidates can prove that they indeed can win those states, but that's what it's all about. A few people in a few counties in a few states, and that's where the Democrats ought to be looking to beat Donald Trump.
I had a little bit of a sick feeling in my stomach this week when the Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, had her CNN presidential town hall. And the reason I got a sick feeling in my stomach is I heard the music that they do for the buildup of, you know, her presidential town hall, and they, you know, faded in, and there was that stage in the auditorium, and all of a sudden I had these feelings of the last presidential election, how painful some of this was, and just to hear that music again, I'm like, no, are we already there again?
Yeah.
And my husband, who's a furniture maker, he doesn't do politics, you know, in a way that I do, he said, is the election in November? And I said, no.
I love Chris. That is awesome.
It's awesome, but the point would be that, oh my goodness, we are entering a presidential campaign again already.
Don't you want to be Chris some days?
Oh, yes. My husband has a wonderful setup.
I mean, I want that. I know it sounds terrible. There are days, like I'm in the middle of the session, I'm all these things, And I talk to people that are out in the real world. They're like, are you guys still meeting?
Uh-huh.
I love it because you tend to think that you're in this bubble and everybody knows everything that's going on. And really, that's not the case.
That's right.
And here we are. We are 2 years into the president's term. Or 2 years from inauguration.
Yeah. And my husband's seen all these people, you know, declare their candidacies. And he's like, oh, it
must be
an election
in November. Yeah, but no, it's 2 years away.
Did you watch any of the Klobuchar things?
She is impressive. She could win the presidency.
You know what I liked about her? And Dan, I don't know if you got a chance to watch it, but she's way more liberal than I am. But she, when people ask something she disagreed with, like someone would say, why don't you, do you want Medicare for all? And she would explain to them why that's not what she supports. She would, in a town hall setting, challenge the person questioning and saying, let me tell you how I approach it, and it's different than you. And I thought that was really healthy.
And that kind of leadership can't win a Democratic nomination. Cannot.
I fell in love with her when, during the Supreme Court hearings, and when the witness was really out of character and had no judicial temperament and went after her and said, do you drink, huh? Do you drink? What about you? Did you ever drink? Did you ever get drunk? And she just was paced. She responded.
Yeah, she's solid.
She responded talented. Just the way you would expect a judge should have responded. That showed me, you know, this woman has got something.
Okay, so do you think she can win the nomination?
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle, and we got to go to a break. In a minute, we'll be back.
No.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Dan McKay, just barely to the right of Natalie.
Jim DeBack is just barely to the left of Natalie.
And Natalie Gochner in the political center. And I like having you guys close to the productive middle.
Whoa, we didn't say that, Natalie.
We can get real problem solving. Some people think the middle's squishy. I think it's where you'd actually get things done.
It's squishy.
Not with my abs. The middle's just fine.
The middle's always, you know, anyways. Yeah.
You know, I'm the youngest of 11 children. And I had to learn how to broker and negotiate, it put me solidly in the middle. Survival.
I had three sisters, so I had a little bit of the same.
Well, I want to talk
about... I'm an oldest child, which gave me no options, but tyranny.
I want to talk about the state budget a little bit and the really important decision facing the legislature. Credit to the governor and credit to legislative leadership, but they're talking about sales tax reform. And I would just say by way of introduction to our listeners that there are these major structural trends that are impacting Utah's sales tax collections. Aging population, which means people spend differently. They spend their money on pensions and health care instead of things that we have a sales tax on. Mm-hmm. We also have remote sales that affects the sales tax. And then you just have health care expenditures going up, which is taking so much of the personal household budget. And so we're spending on health care, not taxable sales.
Yeah.
So it's actually something that isn't, Jim, you'll appreciate this. You don't have to do this right now because we're flush in revenue. It's a good time. We're prosperous. But if you solve these problems during prosperous times, you can avoid the really hard decisions during a difficult time. And I think that's real leadership up on here on the Hill that they're doing that.
Is that a question?
Well, just your comment on it. And well, the reason I bring it up to you is you always want to spend. Spending's always your answer.
He's the fun dad.
No, he's the fun dad.
And this one, they're doing revenue neutral, but they're fixing the structure.
We're talking about cuts. $200 million
yeah,
in cuts.
That's right, that too.
If you had sat through 6 years of revenue tax, you would call me Senator Nyet. Because I really was the only one that consistently said no, 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 no. And all the hands
and
went up
is for Russian
every
for no.
pork, every pork barrel. That came along. You want to really reform sales tax? There's $600 million in sales tax exemptions.
I'm going to run out in the hallway. I'll be back in a minute now.
Right now.
Yeah.
That's where we should start.
And we have some proposals to do that. We do. Dan, will you just take off the table once and for all Jim's constant complaint about the exemptions that are given to manufacturing in the state?
Oh, my goodness.
Explain to him the economic rationale for that so it doesn't seem like a gift, but rather a purposeful thing to help with your economic prosperity.
Audience, I just want you to know, and when an economics professor asks you to give an economics opinion in front of them, it's either A, a compliment, or B, a real trap. So I'm not going to take either one of them, and I'm just going to say
that is clever commentary.
I'm just going to say there are structural problems with the way our tax system is set up now. But what we do not want to create is a VAT, which is a value-added tax, which is European countries have this, and you know, some think it works and some don't. But at every, you know, at every stage of production, there is a tax based on its value at that stage in production. And that tax then gets built into the cost of the good. So the good becomes more expensive. And then that cost of the good gets passed on to the consumer, but the consumer has no idea how much they're paying in taxes. The cost of the good will vary, you know, depending on the cost of the of production, but it will also vary as so we in America have said, look, our process is going to be we will keep taxes transparent, and the primary way that we do that is we say this is your sales tax rate, and anything that we put into the cost of that product that is taxed, that tax is then hidden from the consumer and they can't see it. And so we have in the state, we have taken taxes off of the modes of production and the means of production and said, look, those things aren't going to be taxed, but the consumer is going to know what rate they're, their inputs themselves, but the consumer is going to see what their tax rate is and be able to pass it on. And I know Jim and others want to complain about these like welfare gifts for all these companies, but at the end of the day, those welfare gifts that Jim wants to talk about are real jobs. And they really do mean something to the people who are listening to this program, because 99% of you all have jobs and they are all dependent on this mode of production at some point in the process or another,
Jim,
even if
this,
you're in a service job.
Did this make
job.
You want to take a public finance class at one of our universities?
No, one assumes that
means he would have to stop being fun dad.
One assumes that one is ignorant if they disagree with this tax mind blanching theory. Look, let's get this straight what we're talking about. If you've got a mom-pa carpet cleaning company and you buy a new truck, you pay sales tax on that new truck. But if you're Rio Tinto and you're owned in London, all of the trucks you buy, you don't pay any sales tax, because we may upset Rio Tinto and they may take their copper and go to another state. Or the same is true with so many other small businesses that pay sales tax and must pay sales tax, but we exempted certain kinds of web portals and certain other areas that are not for all businesses. It's just businesses that happen to have very good lobbyists and get the bill written. That's what I'm talking about. There's no principle to this. What there is just a lot of lobbying and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that should be going in our sales tax coffers and aren't. So now the state is frantic to get sales tax on food or make up for that sales tax another way.
From the political middle, I would just say keep an eye on this debate, because I think it's increasingly likely that you'll see more taxes on services in this state and a lower rate and a tax cut.
Yeah, one of the things, and I saw this reported actually, in another news outlet that's less reputable than KCPW, what I would say is they said, well, if tax rates were held the same, some of this, like a tax on hay, alfalfa, and a tax on like vehicle trade-ins.
Yeah.
Most people don't know this. It's an advertisement for dealers. You can use it while you can. But if you go to a dealer to trade in your vehicle, that you get to take that value off of the value of your new car. And when you subtract those two, that delta is what you pay taxes on. It's a little dealer incentive that's in the code.
I just recently was a beneficiary of this, and it surprised me, even being a tax person.
Yep.
And it's actually kind of a nice little deal. It can lower the cost of a new vehicle by $1,000, $1,500.
Sure. And while that's all nice and good for dealers, if you go and buy one off a KSL, you can't get the same advantage.
Yeah.
And so I have, you know, in my mind, I've thought that was somewhat weird. But they said if the rate remained the same, this would generate $119 million in new revenue. And I'm like, that's garbage. None of us intend to keep the rate the same. We are looking for opportunities
to lower that rate.
Lower tax rates.
Okay, guys, let's do some rapid fire here. Okay. There's a lot of things on Capitol Hill. Jim, quick comment.
Don't ask me anything about Jim right now.
On the hate crimes bill going to committee.
We'll see if it passes or not. It shocked me that Senator Milner, the former president of Weber State, now in leadership, is taking up the flagship against the bill. I suspect that being the only woman in leadership and being the only non-Mormon, she is a little bit coerced into picking up a flag that Republican males are leery to pick up.
Dan, any comment on the hate crimes?
Yeah,
has that come across your desk yet?
Yeah, in its current form, I'm not planning to vote for it. We just and please know this is not because I just have a cold heart. I'm saying we just spent 4 years studying our sentencing levels throughout the state, and they had gotten all skiwampus for various crimes, whatever the sympathetic measure was at the time, and whatever heinous crime had been committed. We had sent our sentencing all over the place, and I'm just going to say, after spending all that time doing that, to now go back, and we decided during this Justice Reinitiative Act, we decided that we were going to reduce times and make it about treatment and rehabilitation. Now we're finding ways to add time again, and it is so inconsistent. I am totally sympathetic with the additional crimes.
Okay. I don't have anything I want to add there, but so let's go on to affordable housing. I'll say, as an economist, affordable housing is one of the impediments right now to our continued growth. It's really becoming a problem. Senator Jake Anderegg has a bill that puts $20 million into the Alene Walker Housing Trust Fund, plus a $4 million ongoing. This would do a lot to help with moderate, you know, income housing, affordable housing in our state. So I think this is going to happen, Jim.
Pittance.
Come on. $20 million?
It is nothing.
They're used to getting four, and they're going to get 24.
Exactly. That shows the pittance of the way the legislature thinks. It's an $18 billion budget. We just spent the year before last $1 billion in bonding for roads. This is a crisis. This is where we need to be using
the state
bonding.
Jim, all the money
bonding.
Goes to developers. Does that change
your... It
should,
to get incentives.
Okay,
we
heard
need,
that.
Dan, you'll support this.
My problem... Okay, here's my problem with this. It's not that I have a problem with Jake's efforts. Those things aren't a problem. What it seems we are coming at a crossroads in the state of Utah where, and this is something I'm figuring out, we have a state government that's saying grow, 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 and we have a lot of people in the state who are saying whoa, whoa, whoa. And in my mind, I think we need to have a rational conversation at the state level as to are we growing the way we ought to be or mm-hmm. are we not?
And from the political middle, I would just say that this is a positive step. okay, I want to talk about scholarships for higher education. This can be kind of significant, but you've got an argument going on here about needs-based versus merit-based scholarships. Right now we have the Regent Scholarship that rewards people that really get themselves prepared for college, and that's a good thing, but people are arguing that they have access to other private scholarships, and what we need really are needs-based scholarships. So Representative Darren Owens has a pretty a direction-changing bill here. Dan, is that something you plan to support?
I haven't read the bill.
Okay, so still not, hasn't
answer.
Come over the Senate
yeah.
yet.
To me, it's still out there, and it's a big ask.
Jim, your comment?
It's the only way we're going to deal with intergenerational poverty. It is a down payment. It's long overdue. This is a great step in the right direction.
You said it earlier. I'm going to talk about this during my gripe when it's time.
Okay. You're using some discipline. $50 million to save the salt flat, Bonneville Salt Flats.
$50 million.
It's a pittance, right, Jim? Not enough. We need to put more.
I was surprised to see the price tag that big.
Yeah, I mean, I think it needs a lot more study, as we say.
Oh, I thought you were going to say more
vote
money
for a bill.
Good to hear.
I want everyone. My gripe. I'm just
okay,
going to start.
Okay, it's time for gripes.
I can hold it no longer.
I hope it's not directed at me. Kind of seems like it might be.
It's Fun Dad over here.
Okay, over to
all I'm saying is
Sugar Daddy Jim.
Do you realize how much money Sugar Daddy Jim has spent during the show? And we didn't even talk about Medicaid expansion. I mean, Sugar Daddy Jim has spent money on his favorite tax program. He spent money on affordable housing. He wants to save the Bonneville Flats. You just start ticking through. I think Jim spent over $150 million on the show today.
Well, so I'm just going to say, though, he's got a lot more to spend because you're given a $230 million tax cut.
Well, so. Somebody has to.
And, yeah, exactly.
Just helping you out there, Jim.
Exactly.
But your quick gripe.
I take it. Are we at gripes already?
Yeah, we are.
Oh, I got so many of them.
Let me jump in with one.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to gripe about parking up here at the legislature. You want this to represent the people. You want it to be the people's business that you're about. All the legislators, you know, have this really convenient underground parking, and everyone else is just left to the neighborhoods up here on Capitol Hill. It's something that I think you need to solve.
My favorite bill, HB 288, it's the Gravel Pit Bill of Rights. It says that anybody that owns a gravel pit should be able to increase it, upgrade production, alter methods of every way, regardless of prohibitions or limits imposed by cities or counties. This is the state taking control of every gravel pit in the state to protect a few gravel pit owners. Give me a break.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner, joined by Jim DeBacchus and Senator Dan McKay. Program is produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening.